Testing, 1, 2, 3. This is an interview for the Brickyard Workers Oral History Project at Museum LA. The date is February 21st, 2009, and I'm at the home of Jerry Russo in Lewiston, Maine, and this is Andrea Lumgia. Jerry, could you start just by giving me your full name?
Gerard L. Russo, Gerard Laurent Russo.
And do you go by Jerry?
I go by Jerry with a J.
With a J, okay. And where and when were you born?
I was born in 1930, May 2nd, in Auburn.
And did you grow up in Auburn?
I grew up in Auburn and lived in Auburn until I met my present wife 23 years ago. And then I moved over here. This is her home, which I moved into her home with her here.
And talk to me about where in Auburn you grew up and what that area was like.
I grew up in Western Promenade, which is in the central part, so to speak, of the old section of Auburn. In other words, we were within a mile of the shoe industry and the city of Lewiston. And I went to Lake Street School. At that time, there used to be a hospital in Auburn, which was called the Auburn Private Hospital, which was owned by the McGilvery's. And they closed that hospital sometime in the 40s, and I'm not sure just when.
And what were your parents' names?
My father was Joseph Russo, and my mother was Rosanna Grenier Russo. They were both born and raised in Canada, and came to this country around 1916 in the Haverhill area. Then they moved into the Auburn area around 1918. My mother worked in the shirt factory. There used to be a shirt factory in Lewiston back in the 20s, and my father worked in the shoe industry.
What did he do?
He was a shoe cutter, and he was what they call a foreman in those days. And he used to get the prices for the shoe industry. He was a union man. And he used to get the prices to price shoes for the people in this area out of Brooklyn, New York, which would be more favorable towards the people here in this area. Not being union at that time, if you don't remember, but at that time they used to have, during the early 30s, a strike. And he was quite involved in the strike in the Auburn area.
Yeah. Did he ever talk to you about
No, not really. Not going to talk too much. I was pretty young, being born in 1930.
Right.
My father had his mother and father living with us in a relatively small apartment. We had a six-room apartment, and we were three children. In fact, we were four children that lived there. I had an adopted brother, Ernest Cody. And he became the engineer of St. Mary's Hospital and kept that operating all during the 30s or 40s during the war until he retired about 20 years ago. My folks were saints. They brought up a number of children. Being from Canada, being from large families, my mother brought up four of her nieces to this country from the time they were teenagers till they got married, and they stayed in this country except for one, and she went back to Canada to live. My father, likewise, he brought in four of his nieces and one nephew until they got married, stayed in this country, became citizens, and one went back to Canada. Being brought up on a farm in those days, the Canadian people didn't have very much. In fact, my folks used to help them immensely. And my father had lost a brother at a young age, and he brought up two of his sons. So this is the kind of people my folks were, very charitable.
And I know when I walked in here today, you were talking to me about, for you, family comes first.
Yes.
Do you feel that's where you got it?
Yes, there's no question about it. when I started in the brickyard, I started working in Jimmy's Diner number 1, which was by the railroad tracks on Court Street, almost, let's say, across from Denny's, Mighty Mac, the muffler place there.
Yeah.
And there used to be a Raymond's Lunch on one side of the tracks and Jimmy's Diner on the other side of the track. Then there was Alfred's store next to that. I worked there in 1942 for 1 year washing dishes. Then in 1943, that's when I got my Social Security card, 1942. 1943, I started working in the brickyard at Dennis on Washington Street in Auburn. They were not too far from where I lived, being brought up. I moved from Western Promenade out to Zora Street, off Poland Road in 1938. And went at Dennis for 6 summers. And in those days, to be a part of the family, so to speak, we used to contribute as much as we could because we thought we were being men in our teenagers. So we used to give our pays to my mother. And I gave all my summer pays to my mother. And the only pay that I kept was the last week of the summer, and that was what I used to buy my clothes with, my school clothes.
That's great. So you really can help contribute.
Well, yes, we did. Yeah. Yes, we were people with very little means, and they, in fact, around 1943 or 4, my folks, just to show what kind of people they are, brought up foster kids. Brought up 2 sets of foster kids at 2 different intervals. And they stayed with us a number of years until they graduated from high school and went on from there. But, and as a matter of fact, they probably were taken better care of in some respect as far as having clothing that was new, as opposed to my clothing, which was made, homemade by my mother. She was a great cook and a great seamstress. We had some chickens, and I used to go to Parsons Grange on Minot Avenue and get grain there in 50-pound bags. My mother would take those bags and make sheets out of, or underwear, or handkerchiefs, or whatever. And then out of heavy material, she would make outer jackets for me, and this is how I survived in those days. And the kids from the State Department, they'd have brand new clothing every Christmas, every birthday, every back to school, and I'd have their hand-me-downs. But I enjoyed it, I'm none the worse for it today. Maybe that's how I learned some of my tributes from my folks, because they were the kind of people they were.
Yeah.
So we're happy with what we have. We never knew there was rich and poor people in those days. We were all the same.
Right.
In fact, talk about what do we have to eat. My mother used to go to the store and get bones, hoping there might be some meat on them, and boil them, and make stew, white sauce, and in the white sauce, cornstarch. And she would put either string beans or peas or hard-boiled eggs, and this would be our meal. And we enjoyed it very much. But she did a lot of that kind of stuff, and it was very good, very tasty.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Did she bring any recipes that from her family in Canada?
Yes, she did, but I don't have them. My sisters do.
Yeah.
But I have none of those. Well, yeah.
Do you remember what some of those dishes were that were?
Well, not really, because she could do anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, fricassee she could make, a stew she could make.
Meat pies?
I love her meat pies. Chinese pie. Roast, once in a while, if we were lucky, we'd have a roast beef or a roast pork, but that wasn't very often.
So, talk to me about your time in the brickyard.
I started, as I say, in 1943 when there was child labor, because everybody was in the service in those days. And knowing the Dennis family, they hired me, and I started working big salary in those days, 60 cents an hour. And whereas when I worked in Jimmy's number 1, I worked for 10 cents an hour. So that was a big jump.
Now you were only like 10, 13?
I was 13 when I started in the brickyard. And the other people started off in 90 cents, the older men. And I, near the end of the season, I said, you know, I'm doing their work, and I feel I should have a raise. So they gave me a slight raise. But the following year, I did jump to 90 cents an hour. In fact, that was as much as my father was making in the shoe shop during those days. They weren't making an awful lot of money. And being a shoe cutter, and they used to work 2-3 days a week, maybe four if they were lucky. And then there used to be a place on Park Street, and they used to get what they call their green slips. So if they didn't make the maximum, they'd get a slip, and then they would subsidize the balance of their income, so to speak. But there was no welfare in those days. So we had to provide with whatever we had. But I started as a laborer, naturally being a brickyard is laboring. But I worked in the area which they call wire cutting. And wire cutting is a specialty, but it's not as backbreaking as water strike. Wire cutting, we used to get our clay from the hills behind the brickyard, and we'd get an old tractor there and have a scoop, a big heavy metal scoop, and you'd get the clay and you'd bring it down to the machine that crushed the clay, and you'd throw sand in there to mix it, and it would go on a conveyor belt. And then that conveyor belt would take it in about maybe 50 feet and it'd come onto this platform, this machine. This machine was the size, it was iron. It was the size of a brick, which was probably, eight inches, whatever, by an inch and a half. And it would come down this conveyor, this machine, and it would have wires. And that's why they call it wire cutting. And you'd have a board, there'd be a platform is what it'd be. And the bricks would be packed. And there'd be a machine with a big long arm, metal arm, and this was the backbreaker. You'd go forward with it, and you'd bend backwards and swing around and bring it back up so that the wires wouldn't catch onto the clay. And you'd take about 10 of these pallets, is what they used to call them, and you'd put them on a wheelbarrow, and you'd bring them outside about, maybe 30 yards, and you'd put them in the racks. And in these racks, which was probably 50 feet long and maybe 6 feet tall, you'd slide these racks into these bins, these racks, for drying. And then you'd leave them there for 2 or 3 days, depending on the weather, and you'd separate them to dry in between. Then once those were dry, you'd have to take and wheel those where the kilns might be, which was another 40, 50 feet beyond the racks. And these kilns would be, depending on the orders that they would have early summer, early spring for the season, the size that they might be. But they would probably vary like 10 doors to 20 doors, depending if it's the beginning of the season or the end of the season. And probably about, and I'm guessing, 15 feet high. Now these doors, they were openings like every 3 feet. And it'd go all the way through the length of that kiln. And you would stack the bricks up and toss them four at a time right to the top. And believe me, that's kind of tough for a young kid. And then you'd pull, once all the kilns were done, then you'd start them by burning evenly or unevenly, depending on the color that you wanted. And you have a long pole, which was probably 20 feet long, with a pick on the end. And you'd have slabs. And you'd push those slabs all the way through about halfways. And then you'd do the same thing on the other side. And you'd push them through about halfways. And you'd have the fire going inside, which had to start manually. And you'd burn those for probably a week or 10 days, depending again on the coloring that you wanted. The slabs themselves They had to haul in from a lumber yard from out of town. They could be almost anywhere. And you'd stack them for the season. In other words, you put hundreds and hundreds of cord of wood. Then you'd have to go get those at night and bring it towards the kill. Every once in a while, there might be a bee's nest in there, and you might get stung, or a skunk in the pile. But it was interesting.
And so when the kills were going, were there people there all 24 hours a day?
Or? Yes. The dentists themselves would start them, because they were the experienced people. And then we laborers would come in and work like double shift. We'd work all day, then burn all night, then have the next day off, then work all night and all day, and alternate the shifts. The owner of the brickyard was Mr. Joseph Dennis, and the number one man there was Lawrence Dennis, which was one of his sons. Then he had three other sons, Willie, Larry, and Rosie. And Joseph did have one daughter, Florence, and they lived right there in the next to the yard as a brick house there that they lived in. And Lawrence lived, there was two houses there, and Lawrence lived in the other house. It was a white wooden shingle house there. And they brought up their families there.
What were they like?
They were nice people. You asked me what were they
right,
like?
Right, yeah.
They were family people. They were hard workers. Willie spent a lot of time in the service. The others did not. And he came back after and continued his work. And they all made their living there till they closed the yard, and I'm not sure when they closed the yard. They also did some water striking, which I am not as familiar with. Water striking is a soft brick, like a deformed brick somewhat, and they used to get clay and put it in a pit. And these people that worked in the pit were in their bathing suits because they were in the mud up to their waist, I swear. And then they would mix the sand in there and put it in this revolving water strike machine. They would mix the mud, mix the clay, and it would come out onto pallets. Then they would wheel the pallets and wheel them on the ground and spread them out on the ground for 3 or 4 days to dry out. And they were a totally different kind of brick. These people, it was a back-busting job. I can remember a few of them, like Willie Baker. His father had a wood yard off Taft Avenue in Auburn, off Portland Road. And then there was a fellow named Ben Bizzi, and then there was the Chamberlain brothers. Then I had an uncle, the name of Gerard Grenier. He was also a water striker there. I can't tell you all the people that used to work there. There was a fellow named Labby. I remember him, great big strapping fellow, strong as an ox. But it took somebody with a strong back to do that kind of work. But they would do the same thing. They had their own crew over there, and then they would wheel them. We would sometimes go over there and flip the bricks over to dry for them if they didn't have enough people, because they wouldn't stay there very long. For some reason, that profession, they worked too hard, I guess, and they weren't too interested in even working a season, although some of them did come back.
Was there a lot of turnover at the job?
Yes, there was, but that's because, again, during the war, you didn't get many of the older people. But yes, there was turnover, there's no question. Yes.
Yeah. Now, how many years were you there?
I was there 6 years. Six summers.
Six summers.
From 43 through 48. 43, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Six summers.
Yeah. And what did you do in the winter?
I went to school. Played sports.
Oh, right, because you were only 13.
I was only 13 when I started.
Yeah.
Right, yes.
So when you were 19, you went on to do something else.
I worked for Flanders Clothing Store. And I worked for a year, and I went in the service. I went in the Air Force for 4 years. I went in December the 4th of 1950, and I spent 3 years overseas. I came out 4 years later 1954. And I went back to Flanders. They were good enough to rehire me. They thought I was good help, I guess. And I stayed there until 19. I bought the store a number of years later. That's it. So I came back from overseas and I went back to Flanders.
And what did you do there?
I was a salesman and I was the buyer for about 30 odd years. I owned the store. And I closed the store on November 1st, 1997. My health started to kick in. I had problems. I had a stroke. I had a 4 bypass. I had cancer. I've had back operation. I've had my eyes, the laser treatment. I've gone through the mill, but the good Lord didn't want me. I'm still here. I'm a survivor, you might say.
Right.
I lost 80% of my stomach, and I lost quite a bit of weight, but here I am.
Yeah. Now, talk to me about the Flanders department store. Where was it in town?
Flanders was on Court Street, across from today the Casco Bank, or whatever the bank is there, from the county building, in Dunlap, in that block there.
Okay.
And it opened in 1904. It started down... From I was at 62 Court Street, and they started down at 32 Court Street. And they were there like 4 years, following them, and Mr. Phillips and Mr. Flanders went in business together. And they decided that there wasn't enough business for two men, that one was going to have to buy out the other. So they flipped the coin, and Mr. Flanders won. So he kept the store and he moved up the street and relocated and was there for 90 years, and that's the history of Flanders.
Wow. So was it just a clothing store or was it a department store? Because I said department store, but correct me if I...
Well, it was a men's clothing, started out. And then about, I'm guessing about, maybe in the late 50s, we started bringing some ladies' clothing. Hathaway clothing, Chippewa clothing, and then we brought in Lady Pendleton and Lady Woolrich. And so I was probably 80% men's clothing and 20% ladies' clothing. But we had quality clothing, and we had our own tailors, which we could give the service, which not many stores around here could. In fact, I outlasted the other stores by 20 years or more, which probably... We did well.
Yeah.
We did well until we closed.
What were some of the other stores that were your competition?
There was Benoit's.
Yeah.
There was Cobb Watson. There was Cronin and Root. I'll start by Auburn. There was Flanders, Cobb Watson, Cronin and Root. And, Haskell and Hopkins. Haskell and Hopkins. They were in Auburn. Then Haskell and Hopkins moved to Lewiston. Then in Lewiston you had Sears Roebuck. That had low-end merchandise, work clothes, had pennies, low-end clothing and work clothes primarily. Then you had Peck's, the big department store, which carried ladies, men's, children's, which was middle-class clothing. Then you go up further up on Main Street, you had Frank's, that was in there for a short period of time, men's clothing. And then you came down Lisbon Street and you had Juddy's, which was a high fashion store, but very small, maybe 20 by 30, which was a nice store. Then you had Grant Clothing. Oscar Benoit and his son ran a fine store, what I call middle class clothing, price range. And then you had LeBlanc's, which was quality clothing. And you had Benoit's, you had O.L. Benoit's, that was here for a very short time. Then you had Tony Fornia, and he was there for a short time. I'm sure I probably skipped a couple of others,
That's
but
okay.
There was a number of stores back then, and they all disappeared.
Was it hard in later years to have tailors? Was that a...
Ladies' clothing was not heavy work. Men's clothing was heavy work. When I say heavy work, it's heavy construction. We used to take a coat apart and take the collar off, reinsert the collar. We used to lower the one collar or one shoulder to the other. We used to change the hymo in the collar, like a custom-made coat. We used to lower waistbands. Not every store could do that. Not every store had a tailor. So that's probably why we were successful in what we were doing. I had a lady by the name of Mary Petrakis from the old country. She came here from Greece. And she, in those days, they learn a profession. You learn to tailor and you work for nothing for a year. And then she went to work for Mr. Young, who taught her the tailoring business. And then she came to Flanders to work for Flanders in 1950, I believe. And she was there until she retired, and I'm guessing somewhere around the 70s. She was in her late 70s. And we also had a very close friend of hers, Mary Goronitis, that did a lot of busheling for us. Mary Goronitis is Olympia Snow's aunt. In fact, brought up Olympia Snow. And I won't go into that history.
I had a wonderful chance. I interviewed her a few years ago.
Olympia?
No.
Mary Goronitis? Yes. Yeah, lovely people. Yes. Then we had two or three other women after that because of age, retirement. And you say it was a heavy work. Yes. We didn't just do cuffs on a shirt or cuffs on a coat or bottoms or waist. That's what we used to call busheling. And so most any seamstress can do that. But tailoring is a different profession. Tailor is not what we call a seamstress, which is what a woman would do in seamstress work.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm interested to know, you worked for Flanders for a few years, and then you bought Flanders. How did that come about?
I guess they felt sorry for me. I was there for so many years that they thought I was doing a pretty decent job, and they offered me the store, and I bought it.
Yeah. Huh. So that was something you really wanted to do.
Yes, that's something I always wanted, it was one of my first jobs, you know. Started there before I went in the service and came back out and worked there for 48 years. It's quite a longevity, you might say. Yeah. Not many people can say that they worked in a place for 48 years.
And tell me what your involvement was with the community. We touched on this just briefly before the interview.
Well, I was always interested in people and things. Started, I guess you might say, in the church, Sacred Heart Church. Being born in Sacred Heart Parish, we had an old barn for our church before they built the present church in 1938. I think it's somewhere around July 3rd, 1938, they built this present church. But before that, it was an old barn with the hus stables.
And where is it located?
That was directly behind the Second Heart Church today on Western Avenue.
Right.
It was directly behind that. When they built the church in front on Western Avenue, they tore down the church behind there. So I got involved with the church. I was on the first council of the church, and from there I was in the men's club, and I was involved with the youth groups in the church. I coached basketball, and I got married in 1956 and lived on Western Avenue and got very involved with the athletic programs in the church, and my kids going to Sacred Heart School back there. I got involved in a lot of different activities in the church, whether it was raffles or bean suppers or chop suey suppers or...
Okay.
And then from there.
And you also got involved politically.
Politically, I got involved. One thing led to another, being involved in the church and groups and organization. I was part of the High Y and the Key Club and the school at the same time, you might say. And then from there, I got involved with so many different activities. I was Man of the Year back in 1974, and I was president of the Key Club, Chamber of Commerce, and the Red Cross, and I can go on and on to many different... Grandstand Club. I was the original, one of the charter members of Grandstand Club, the original president there for two or three years. I helped with all the different activities, the building of the fields out there and what have you. And then I, Chamber of Commerce, I told you that.
Yeah. Now, how did you become a member of the Auburn City Council?
In 1958, I didn't like the way the community was going. And I decided, if you're going to don't like what you see, do something about it. So I ran for council and I got elected. And then there were two-year terms and I got elected in two different terms. And I decided I had enough and I got out. But I kept get myself involved in different committees and different associations within the community and in the city on different boards. And then in 1974, I was one of the originals that got Jim Lawley to run for governor and got him elected governor.
Now, can you talk to me a little bit about that? What did you do to get involved with persuading him or helping him?
Well, through the Chamber of Commerce, we had different breakfasts and things, and we decided that we wanted somebody local that was a good man with good reputation, a businessman, well-known in the community, and Jim being independent and had all the credentials of being a governor. Ray Geiger, Ray Philbrick, Malcolm Philbrick, Bill Botts, I can go on, myself, Bill Tui, a number of us got him to run. And in those days, none of us were experienced politicians. We were all looking for the best candidate that we thought would best serve the state of Maine, and we wanted somebody local. So we got Jim to run, and they said, okay, where are you going to be best suited? And we all thought we would like different parts of whatever we were doing. So I ended up being getting volunteers and raising money in three different counties, Endicott County, Kennebec County, up in the Norway area, in the Augusta area. I was very in Lisbon Falls, Durham. I was very fortunate in New Gloucester to get some good people that would say yes. And they volunteered to go out and knock on doors and help me raise money. And like the old saying goes, if you don't do it, why, it won't get done. So Jim used to say, do it your way. So I did what I did my way, and we were successful and helped get Jim elected.
Well, what was that election like in terms of, you probably saw George Mitchell also running, and I'm blanking on the name of the Republican candidate. Was it Jim Irwin?
Jim Irwin. Yeah. Yes.
How did they, I know you supported Longley, how did the others match up with?
Well, Jim Irwin was a Republican, Mitchell was the Democrat, and Longley was the independent. And they never gave us a chance because they figured Mitchell would probably win. Well, we fooled them. And due to hard work and but they were all great candidates. They're all good people. In fact, George Mitchell has proven to be one of the great Americans, as far as I'm concerned, for what he has done for this country and for other countries all around the USA. We were very fortunate to have George Mitchell as one of our people. And had it been any other time, I probably would have supported George Mitchell. But being Jim Long and a very close friend, you stuck with your own people.
Right. Yeah. And what was he like as a governor, from your perspective?
From my perspective, he was A1. Jim died of cancer, as you know, and he always said he'd be a one-term governor. And it's too bad, because he would have done great things had he been able to do his second term. But he was not able to, and being a one-term governor, he did not accomplish all the things that he would like to have. But government was overstaffed, and still is. You have two people doing one person's work in government, like you do in the military. You got three people doing one person's work, and the other guys are working around, walking around with a clipboard, making them look busy. But Jim cut back on people in government and saved the state an awful lot of money. And he had the foresight, being in business, being in insurance business, he had the foresight of knowing how to run a business. And he was very successful in his business and also as governor.
Well, there was another statewide but local politician that you and I are both familiar with the name of, Louis Jalbert.
Did you ever get in a position? Say something.
And so I was wondering, like, what made Louis Jalbert tick, maybe? You know, what were some of the challenges in working with him? Because I know he had sort of this colorful personality, and he had some power politically, and did some good things, and then created challenges for people who he worked with.
Yes. Louis Jalbert was what they called Mr. Democrat in Lewiston. But me being from Auburn, we were on two sides of the fence, so we didn't always agree. But Louis was for the older people, there's no question about it. He was a party man. With Louis, there was only one party, and that was the Democratic Party. And when you went to the polls, you didn't check off who you wanted to vote for. You just put a big X up there. Which, in Auburn, we didn't do things that way. We voted primarily more independent and voted for the people, for the person that we thought was best qualified. But Louis did do a lot of good things. He was instrumental in bringing the local college into town, and which was on Turner Street in Auburn. Which was probably the finest location around for a college. It was what they used to call the old poor farm in Auburn, and down on Lake Auburn. And he was very instrumental in helping getting them there. But I'm going to say this one step further. When I was on the Chamber of Commerce, if I recollect, we started then college in the city of Auburn in Lewiston. And that was like a one-room college. It started, I think, in a DeWitt Hotel. The Chamber subsidized it. Malcolm Philbrick was one of the instigators that really, really pushed for higher education in Auburn and Lewiston. Some people have given other people credit, but he was the head of the board on the Chamber of Commerce, the educational board. And he got to have the University of Maine bring in, I think they used Walton School for a couple of years, they used Webster School a couple of years, they used Sacred Heart School for a couple of years, and they bounced around different areas because of costs, and then they started growing from there, and they became part of the campus of the University of Maine. And so it grew from there to what it is today, which is one of the greatest assets to the area, is having the Auburn Lewiston campus of University of Maine here in the two cities.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I give Malcolm Philbrick a lot of credit for the past history of the University of Maine in Auburn and Lewiston.
I have one more question. And it goes back to what you were talking about, your parents brought over your father's parents from Canada and they stayed with you.
Yeah, and my mother's parents.
And your mother's parents as well.
Yes.
And did, Did you get to know them? I don't know how many years it was that they were with you. Did you really get to know them? I'd love to hear that.
I vaguely remember my grandfather. I was like 3 years old when he died. My grandmother Russo, we're talking about.
Yeah.
My grandmother Russo lived with us until she was, I think, 85 or 86. I think she died somewhere around 1945. And she lived with us. And in those days, we didn't go to funeral parlors. You had the funerals, processions all done in your home. And what they would do is they would put a flower, or a bouquet of flower outside the door, and signifying that there was death in the family. And everything was done in the home. And then my grandmother, Grenier, she lived with us off and on for years, not permanently like my grandmother Russo did. And then she went back to Canada to live. My grandfather, Grenier, died during the Second World War, and I got never to know him.
That was a lot of extended family under one roof.
That was.
How did it affect you growing up? You had a sense of all these generations of family.
We knew that the beginning of that was when we lived on Western Promenade, and we had just an apartment to live in. Then when we moved out to Zora Street, below Six Corners, we had a two-story house. We had a lot more room, so there was more room for these nieces and nephews that came to live here from Canada. They lived as housekeepers because they were only like 13, 14, 15 until they were old enough to live in the factory, to work in the factories. But then they stayed here for the most part and got married here and raised their families here. My mother's folks were brought up on a farm, and my father likewise. But they had sugar factories on their farm, and they had cows and pigs and whatever. And the government in those days used to help subsidize the Canadians. And what they would do is they would give them land, extended land, so they could grow. And enlarge their farm by this land that this government subsidized them with. And then some of them retired there, and others just completely retired. And
Just to end the interview, I wanted to ask if there was anything that I haven't asked you that you think is important to add. And so, Jerry, I want to thank you very much for the interview.
You are welcome, and I hope that I was able to convey something to you that might be instrumental and beneficial to the
museum.
Yes, to the museum.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I know that there are others that might have done a little better job, but there aren't that many people around today.
No, there aren't many brickmakers. Thank you.
You're